Chapter 5. We are learning all the time. Hopefully, at least some of you are learning right here in this class. Dr. Treadwell's students laughed nervously, but she continued over them. It had apparently not been a joke. When we learn, our minds must decide where we will store that information. Unconsciously, we determine what group of things it is most relevant to and connected to that group. This is, of course, only the most rudimentary explanation. When computers do this, we call it an information tree. Charlie was only half listening. She knew this already and was taking her notes on autopilot. Since their expedition to Freddy's the day before, she hadn't been able to get the image of Dave's body out of her head. His torso in the gruesome lace of scars that had covered it. When he was alive, he'd shown them off to her, boasting of his survival. While he never told her what had happened, it must have been an accident. He used to wear those suits all the time. She could see him now, before all the murders, dressed as a yellow bunny and dancing merrily with a yellow bear. She shook her head suddenly, trying to get rid of the image. "Are you okay?" Artie whispered. She nodded, waving him off. But the dead man in the field, that wasn't an accident. Someone forced him inside. But why? Charlie restlessly tapped her fingers on her desk. "That will be all for today." Dr. Treadwell set down her chalk and stalked off the auditorium stage with a purposeful step. Her teaching assistant, a flustered graduate student, scurried forward to collect the homework. "Hey, do you have any time to go over some of this?" Artie asked Charlie as they gathered up their things. "I'm in a little bit over my head in this class." Charlie paused. She'd promised to make up her first date with John, but she wasn't meeting him for over an hour. Now that she'd been to Freddy's, Charlie almost felt like she was on familiar ground, even if it was soaked in blood. "I have some time now," she told Artie, who lit up. "Great, thanks so much. We can go work over at the library." Charlie nodded. "Sure." She followed him across the campus, only half engaged as he explained his difficulties with the material. They found a table, and Charlie opened her notebook to the pages she'd taken down today, pushing them across so Artie could see them. "Actually, do you mind if I sit next to you?" he asked. "It's easier if we're both looking at the same thing, right?" "Oh, yeah." Charlie pulled her notes back over as he came around and sat next to her, scooting his metal folding chair next to hers, just a few inches closer than she would have preferred. "So, where did you get lost?" she asked him. "I was telling you on the way over," he said, with a hint of reproach in his voice, then cleared his throat. "I guess I understood the beginning of the lecture, when she was reviewing last week's material." Charlie laughed. "So basically you want to review everything new from today?" Artie nodded sheepishly. Charlie started from the beginning, pointing at her notes as she went. As she flipped through the pages, she noticed her own scribbles in the margins. Charlie leaned in closer, where harsh outlines of rectangles lined the bottom of the page. They were all colored in, like slabs of granite. She stared at them with a sensation of déjà vu. They were important. "I don't remember drawing that," she thought uneasily. Then, "It's just doodles. Everybody doodles." She turned the page to the next segment of the lecture, and a strange alertness rose at the base of her neck, as if someone might be watching her. There were more doodles in the margins of this page, too, and the next one. All of them were rectangles. Some were large and some were small, some scribbled and some outlined in so solidly that her pen had wet the paper through and torn it. All of them were vertical, taller than they were wide. Charlie stared, tilting her head to see from different angles, until something pinged inside her. Sammy? She thought. Then, is this you? Does this mean something I don't understand? Charlie glanced at Artie. He was staring at the paper, too. As she watched, he turned the page again. The next pages were the same. They were filled with neat, clear notes, but little rectangles were squashed into every available spot on the page, stuffed into the space between bullet points, crammed into the margins, and tucked away where lines came up short. Quickly, Artie flipped the page back. He looked up at her and smiled, but his eyes were wary. "Why don't you try the first problem here?" Charlie suggested. Artie bent over his worksheet, and Charlie stared down at her notebook. Her mind kept returning to her father's house, and the shapes she'd drawn only made the impulse stronger. "I have to go back."
"Are you okay?"
Artie leaned in cautiously. Charlie stared down at her notebook. Now that she'd noticed the rectangles, they seemed more prominent than the notes. She could focus on nothing else. "I have to go back." Charlie shut the notebook and blinked hard. She ignored Artie's question, shoving the notebook into her backpack. "I have to go," she said as she stood up.
"But I'm still stuck on the first problem," Artie said.
"I'm sorry, I really am," she called over her shoulder as she hurried away. She bumped into two people as she passed the circulation desk, but was too flustered to mutter an apology. When she got to the door, she stopped, her guts twisting. "There's something wrong." She hesitated, her hand suspended in the air, as if something was blocking her path. She finally took hold of the knob, and instantly her hand felt fused to it, as if by an electrical current. She couldn't turn it, and she couldn't let go. Suddenly, the knob moved on its own. Someone was turning it from the other side. Charlie yanked her hand away and stepped back as a boy with an enormous backpack brushed past her. Snapping back into the moment, she slipped out before the door could swing shut again. Charlie sped toward Hurricane, trying to calm herself as she drove. The windows were cracked open and wind was rushing in. She thought back to Treadwell's lecture earlier in the week. "At every moment, your senses are receiving far more information than they can process all at once." Maybe that was Artie's problem in class. Charlie gazed at the mountains ahead, the open fields on either side. Watching them go by, she began to feel like some restraint had been loosened. She'd been spending too much time in her room or in class, and not enough out in the world. It was making her jumpy, exaggerating her natural awkwardness. She rolled her window down farther, letting in the air. Over the field to her right, a few birds were circling. No. Charlie stopped the car. Something is wrong. She got out, feeling ridiculous, but the last few days had put her on a hair trigger. The birds were too large. She realized they were turkey vultures, and some of them were already on the ground, cautiously approaching what looked like a prone figure. Could be anything. She leaned against the car. Probably just a dead animal. After another moment, she turned back toward her car in frustration, but didn't get in. It's not a dead animal. She clenched her teeth and started to the spot the vultures were circling. As she got closer, the birds on the ground flapped their wings at the sight of her and soared away. Charlie dropped to her knees. It was a woman. Charlie's eyes went first to her clothing. It was ripped up, just like the dead man Clay Burke had shown her. She leaned over to check the woman's neck, though she knew what she would find. There were deep, ugly gouges from the spring locks of an animatronic suit. But before she could examine them closely, Charlie stopped, horrified.
She looks just like me. The woman's face was bruised and scratched, which obscured her features. Charlie shook her head. It was easier to imagine more of a resemblance than there really was. But her hair was brown and cut like Charlie's, and her face was the same round shape, with the same complexion. Her features were different, but not that different. Charlie stood up and took a deliberate step back from the woman, suddenly aware of how exposed she was in the open field. Clay, I need to call Clay. She looked up at the sky, wishing for a way to keep the vultures at bay, to protect the body. I'm sorry, she whispered to the dead woman. I'll be back. Charlie started off to her car, then broke into a run, faster and faster across the field until she ran like something was right behind her. She got in and slammed the door, locking it as soon as she was inside. Panting heavily, Charlie thought for a second. She was about halfway between Hurricane and the school, but there was a gas station just down the road where she could call Clay. With a last glance at the spot where the body lay, Charlie pulled out onto the road. The gas station seemed to be empty. As she arrived, Charlie realized that she had never actually seen anyone fueling up here. Is this a working gas station? The place was old and shabby, which she had noticed in passing, but she'd never stopped to look around. The pumps looked functional, though not new, and there was no shelter above them. They simply stood on concrete blocks in the middle of a gravel driveway, exposed to the weather. The little building attached to the station might have been painted white once, but the paint had worn down to reveal gray boards underneath. It seemed to be tilting slightly, slipping on its foundation. There was a window, but it was filthy, almost the same color gray as the building's outside walls. Charlie hesitated, then went to the door and knocked. A young man answered, about Charlie's age, wearing a St. John's College t-shirt and jeans. Yeah? He said, giving her a blank stare. Are you open? Yeah. He was chewing gum and wiped his hands on a grimy rag. Charlie took a deep breath. I really need to use your phone. The boy opened the door and let her in. There was more space inside than she'd thought. In addition to the counter, there was a convenience store, though most of the shelves were empty and the line of refrigerators at the back was dark. The young man was looking at Charlie expectantly. Can I use your phone? She asked again. Phones for customers only, he said. Okay. Charlie glanced back at her car. I'll get gas on the way out. Pump's broken. Maybe you want something out of the cooler, he said, nodding at a grimy freezer with a sliding glass top and a faded patch of red paint that must once have been a logo. We've got popsicles. I don't want... Fine, I'll take a popsicle, Charlie said. Pick out any one you want. Charlie leaned into the cooler. Pale, glassy eyes stared back at her. Beneath them was a furry red muzzle, its mouth open and poised to snap. Charlie screamed and hurtled backward, banging into the shelf behind her. Several cans fell off the shelf and rolled across the floor. The sound echoed in the empty space. What is that? Charlie yelled, but the boy was cackling so hard he was gasping for breath. Peering back inside, Charlie realized that someone had placed a taxidermic animal in the cooler, maybe a coyote. That was great, he finally managed to say. Charlie drew herself up, shaking with rage. I would like to use your phone now, she said coldly. The boy beckoned her to the counter, all smiles, and handed her a rotary phone. No long distance, though, he warned. Charlie turned her back and dialed, walking toward the cooler as the phone rang. She peered in from the top, studying the stuffed canine from the high angle.
Clay Burke here.
Clay, it's Charlie. Listen, I need you to meet me. It's another... She glanced at the young man behind the counter, who was watching her intently, not trying to hide the fact that he was listening. It's like that thing you showed me before, with the cows.
What? Charlie, where are you?
I'm at a gas station a few miles from you. Looks like someone painted an outhouse.
Hey!
The boy behind the counter straightened for a moment, taking offense.
Right, I know where you're at. I'll be right there.
There was a click from the other end. Thanks for the phone, Charlie said begrudgingly, and left without waiting for a reply. Charlie crouched again where the woman's body lay. She looked anxiously up the road for Clay's car, but it didn't appear. At least the vultures hadn't returned. I could just stay in the car until he gets here, she thought. But Charlie didn't move from her spot. This woman had died horribly and been abandoned in a field. Now, at least, she didn't have to be alone. The more Charlie looked at her, the harder it was to dismiss the resemblance. Charlie shivered, even though the sun was warm on her back. She was filling with a cold, crawling dread.
Charlie?
Charlie spun around to see Clay Burke, then sighed and shook her head.
Sorry, I got here as fast as I could,
he said lightly. She smiled. It's okay. I'm just on edge today. I think that's the third time I've jumped in the air when someone said my name. Clay wasn't listening. His eyes were fixed on the body. He knelt carefully beside it, scrutinizing it. Charlie could almost see him filing every detail away. She held her breath, not wanting to disturb him.
Did you touch the body?
He asked sharply, not looking away from the corpse. Yes, she admitted. I checked to see if she had the same injuries as the man.
Did she?
Yes, I think... I know she was killed the same way. Clay nodded. Charlie watched as he got up and circled the woman, dropping down to look more closely at her head, and again at her feet. Finally, he turned his attention to Charlie again.
How did you find her?
He asked. I saw birds, vultures, circling above the field. I went to check.
Why did you go to check?
His eyes were hard, and Charlie felt a trickle of fear. Surely Clay didn't suspect her. Why wouldn't he? She thought. Who else would know how to use the spring locks? I bet he could come up with a million theories about me. Twisted girl avenges father's death. Acts out psychodrama. Film at 11. She took a deep breath, meeting Clay's eyes. I checked because of the body you showed me. It was in a field. I thought it might be another one. She kept her voice as steady as she could. Clay nodded, the steely expression slipping from his face, replaced by worry.
Charlie, this girl looks like you, he said bluntly.
Not that much like me.
She could be your twin, Clay said.
No, Charlie said, more harshly than she intended. She looks nothing like my twin. Clay gave her a puzzled look, then comprehension dawned.
I'm sorry. You had a twin, didn't you? Your brother.
I barely remember him, she said softly, then swallowed. All I do is remember him. I know she looks like me, she added weakly.
We're right near a college town, Clay said. She's a young white female with brown hair. You're not a rare type, Charlie. No offense.
Do you think it's a coincidence? Clay didn't look at her.
There was another body found this morning, he said.
Another girl? Charlie drew closer.
Yes, as a matter of fact. Been dead for a couple of days. Probably killed two nights ago.
Charlie looked down at him in alarm. Does that mean this is going to keep happening?
Unless you think we can stop it, he said.
Charlie nodded. I can help, she said. She looked again at the woman's face. She's nothing like me. Let me go to her house, she added abruptly, seized by a sudden impulse to prove it, to gather evidence that she and the victim were not the same.
What? Her house? Clay said, giving her a dubious look.
You asked me to help, Charlie said. Let me help. Clay didn't answer. Instead, he reached into the woman's pockets one by one, searching for her wallet. He had to move the body to do it, and she jerked a little as he did, like a ghastly puppet. Charlie waited, and at last he came back with her wallet. He handed Charlie her driver's license. Tracy Horton, she read. She doesn't look like a Tracy.
You got the address?
Clay scanned the road for police cars. Charlie read it quickly and handed the license back.
I'm going to give you 20 minutes before I radio this in, he told her. Use it.
Tracy Horton had lived in a small house off a back road. Her nearest neighbor's houses were visible, but Charlie couldn't imagine they would have heard her scream, if she'd managed to scream at all. There was a small blue car in the driveway, but if Tracy had been taken from her home, since presumably she hadn't just been wandering through that field, it could easily have been hers. Charlie pulled in behind the car and went to the front door. She knocked, wondering what she was going to do if someone answered. I really should have thought this through. She couldn't be the one to inform a parent, spouse, or sibling of the young woman's death. Why did I assume she lived alone? No one answered. Charlie tried again, and when there was still no response, she tried the door. It was unlocked. Charlie walked quietly through the house, not really sure what she was looking for. She glanced at her watch. 10 of the 20 minutes had passed just driving here, and she had to assume that the police would get here faster than she did. Why did I follow the speed limit the whole way here? The living room and kitchen were clean, but they conveyed no information to her. Charlie didn't know what peach-painted walls said about a person, or the fact that there were 3 dining room chairs instead of 4. There were 2 bedrooms. One had the sterile air of a guest room that was slowly being taken over by storage. The bed was made and clean towels were folded on the chest of drawers, but cardboard boxes filled 1/4 of the room. The other bedroom looked lived in. The walls were green, the bedspread pale blue, and there were piles of clothing on the floor. Charlie stood in the doorway for a moment and found she could not go inside. I don't even know what I'm looking for. This woman's life would be sifted through to the last grain by trained investigators. Her diary would be read, if she had one. Her secrets would be revealed, if she had any. Charlie didn't need to be a part of it. She turned and walked quickly but quietly back to the front of the house, almost running down the front steps. Standing by the car, she checked her watch again. 6 minutes before Clay called in the body. Charlie went to the little blue car and peered inside. Like the house, it was neat. There was dry cleaning hanging in the back window and a half-empty soda in the cup holder. She walked all around it, looking for something. Mud in the tires, scratches in the paint. But there was nothing unusual. 5 minutes. She walked briskly through the unkempt grass that bordered the sides of the house. When she reached the backyard, she stopped dead. Before her were 3 huge holes in the ground, longer than they were wide. They looked like graves, but at a second glance they were too messy, their outlines poorly defined. Charlie walked around them in a circle. They were lined up next to one another, and they were shallow, but the dirt at the bottom was loose. Charlie grabbed a stick off the ground and poked it into the middle hole. It went in almost a foot before it was stopped by denser soil. The dirt dug out of them was strewn messily all around. Whoever dug the holes had carelessly tossed it everywhere, not bothering to pile it up. 2 minutes. Charlie hesitated for another moment, then lowered herself into the middle hole. Her feet sunk into the loose dirt, and she fought to steady herself, catching her balance. It wasn't too deep. The walls came up to her waist. She knelt and put her palm against the wall of the grave. The hole, she reminded herself. The dirt was loose here, too, and the wall was rough. Something had been hidden there, under the ground. The air is growing thin. I am running out of oxygen, and I will die like this, alone, in the dark. Charlie's throat seized. She felt as if she couldn't breathe. She climbed out of the hole and up onto the grass of Tracy Horton's backyard. Charlie took a deep breath, focusing all her attention on pushing away the panic. When she was free of it, she checked her watch. -1 minute. He's already called them. But something kept her there. Something familiar. The loose dirt. Charlie's mind raced. Something climbed out of these. From a distance, a siren was wailing. It would be here in no time. Charlie hurried to her car and pulled out of the driveway, taking the first corner without caring where it would take her. The holes stayed in her mind, the image like a stain. Chapter 6. Charlie slowed her car. With half the cops and Hurricane converging on the area, now was not the time to be stopped for speeding. She was grubby with dirt from the dead woman's backyard and had a nagging feeling there was something she was forgetting about. John, she realized. She was supposed to meet him, she checked the clock on the dashboard, almost 2 hours ago. Her heart sank. He'll think I stood him up. No, he'll think I'm dead, she amended. Given the perilous history of their relationship, he'd probably think the second was more likely. When she got to the restaurant where they had planned to meet, a small Italian place across town, Charlie ran in from the parking lot at full speed. She skidded to a stop in front of the teenage hostess, who greeted her with a flustered look.
Can I help you?
She asked Charlie, taking a step back. Charlie caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror behind the hostess counter. There were streaks of dirt on her face and clothes. She hadn't thought to clean up first. She quickly wiped her cheeks with her hands before answering the girl.
I'm supposed to be meeting someone. A tall guy, brown hair. It's kind of...
She gestured vaguely at the top of her head, attempting to indicate the habitual chaos of John's hair, but the hostess looked at her blankly. Charlie bit her lip in frustration.
He must have left. Of course he left. You're 2 hours late.
Charlie? A voice rang out.
John. You're still here?
She cried, too loud for the quiet restaurant, as he appeared behind the hostess, looking profoundly relieved.
I figured I might as well eat while I'm here.
He swallowed what was in his mouth and laughed.
Are you okay? I thought you might not be coming.
I'm fine. Where are you sitting? Or are you still sitting? Well, I mean, you're obviously not sitting, you're standing, but I mean, before you were standing, where were you sitting?
Charlie ran her fingers into her hair and clenched her fists against her scalp, trying to reassemble her thoughts. She mumbled an apology to the room, not sure who it was for. John glanced around nervously, then gestured toward a table near the kitchen. There was a mostly empty plate with a half-eaten breadstick resting on it, a cup of coffee, and a second place setting, untouched. They sat down and he looked at her appraisingly. Then John leaned across the table and asked in a low voice,
Charlie, What happened?
You wouldn't believe me if I told you? She said lightly.
His face remained concerned. You're filthy. Did you fall down in the parking lot?
Yes, Charlie said. I fell in the parking lot and rolled down a hill and into a dumpster, then fell out of the dumpster and tripped on the way in. Happy? Stop looking at me like that.
Like what?
Like you have the right to disapprove of me.
John pulled back in his chair, his eyes wide. He blinked hard, and Charlie sighed.
John, I'm sorry. I'll tell you everything. I just need some time. Some time to collect my thoughts and to clean up.
She laughed, an exhausted, shaken sound, then buried her face in her hands. John leaned back and signaled for the waitress to bring the check. Breathing heavily, Charlie looked around the restaurant. It was almost empty. The hostess and the only other waitress were talking together near the door, with no apparent interest in anything their customers were doing. There was a family of four by the front window, the children just barely out of toddlerhood. One kept sliding out of his chair and onto the floor every time his mother turned her attention away. The other, a girl, was happily drawing on the tablecloth with markers. No one seemed to care what was going on. But the emptiness made Charlie feel exposed.
I'm going to go clean up, she said. Bathroom?
John pointed.
Charlie got up and left the table just as the waitress arrived to deliver his ticket. There was a payphone in the hallway, and Charlie stopped at it, wavering.
She craned her neck to see if John was watching, but from where she stood, she could only see a tiny corner of their table. Quickly, she called Clay Burke's office. To her surprise, he answered.
You saw her backyard, he said.
It wasn't a question.
Can you give me the other addresses? Charlie asked. There could be a pattern. Something.
There sure could, he said dryly. That's why I raced back to the station instead of sticking around to measure the holes. You have a pen?
Hang on.
The hostess was briefly absent from her station, and Charlie dropped the phone, letting it swing on its metal cord as she hurried to the podium and snatched a pen and a takeout menu. She rushed back.
Clay, go ahead.
He recited names and addresses, and she scribbled them dutifully in the margins of the menu.
Thanks, she said when he was done, and hung up without waiting for him to respond.
She folded the menu and slipped it into her back pocket. In the bathroom, Charlie washed off as much of the dirt as she could. She couldn't clean her clothing, but at least her face was scrubbed, and her hair was rearranged a little more neatly. As she moved to exit the bathroom, an image flashed unbidden through her thoughts. It was the face of the dead woman.
She could be your twin, she heard Clay say, in his low, authoritative voice.
Charlie shook her head. It's a coincidence. He's right. How many brown-haired, college-aged women are there around here? The first victim was a man. It doesn't mean anything. She grabbed the doorknob to leave, but froze. It was just like in the library. Charlie released the knob, and it spun slowly back into position, releasing a horrible creak as it moved. The costumes had been disturbed, and the creaking noise was so faint and careful she scarcely even heard it. Charlie looked up from her game. There was a figure in the door. Charlie glanced wildly around the room, pulling herself back to the present. With a swell of panic, Charlie pulled on the bathroom door, but it had somehow sealed shut. She mouthed words, but no sound came out.
I know you're there. I'm trying to get to you. I have to get inside, she screamed.
The door burst open and Charlie fell into John's arms.
Charlie!
She collapsed to her knees. Charlie looked up to see the scattered handful of customers all staring at her. John glanced into the bathroom behind her, then quickly turned his attention back to Charlie, helping her to her feet.
I'm okay. I'm fine. She shook loose of his hands. I'm fine. The door was stuck. I felt hot.
Charlie fanned at her face, trying to make a sensible story of it.
Come on, let's get to the car.
He tried to take her arm again, but she shook free.
I'm fine.
She dug her keys out of her pocket and walked straight for the door, not waiting for him. An old woman was openly staring at Charlie, her fork suspended in the air. Charlie returned her stare.
Food poisoning,
Charlie said plainly. The woman's face went pale, and Charlie walked out the door. When they got out to her car, John sat down in the passenger's seat and looked at Charlie expectantly.
You're sure you're okay?
It's been a rough day, that's all. I'm sorry.
What happened?
Tell him what happened, Charlie thought.
I want to go to my dad's, my old house, she said instead, surprising herself.
Be honest, her inner voice said harshly. You know what kind of creature is doing this, and you know who built it. Stay focused.
Right, he said, his voice softening. You haven't seen it since the storm.
She nodded.
He thinks I want to see the damage.
She'd forgotten about the storm until now, but the sudden kindness in John's voice made her nervous.
Is there anything left?
She imagined the house raised to the ground and felt a sudden wrongness, like a part of her had been ripped away. She'd never thought of the house as anything but a house, but now, as she drove toward what was left of it, she felt a painful knot in her stomach. It was where all her clearest memories of her father were kept, his rough hands building her toys, showing her his new creations in his workshop, and holding her close when she was afraid. They'd lived there together, just the two of them, and it was the place where he had finally died. Charlie felt as if the joy, the sorrow, the love, and the anguish of their two lifetimes had poured off into the very bones of the old house. The idea of it being wrecked by a storm was an utter violation. She shook her head and gripped the wheel tighter, suddenly aware of how angry she was. Her love of the house, even of her father, could never be simple. They had both betrayed her. But now there was a new monster out there. She clenched her jaw, trying to fight the tears that welled up in her eyes.
Dad, what did you do?
As soon as they were out of the town center, Charlie sped up. Clay would be tied up dealing with the newest victim for a while, but eventually he would think to come to her father's house as well. She could only hope that she'd connected the dots first.
You're on the same side.
Charlie put a hand to her head and rubbed her temple. The impulse to guard her father's reputation from what was coming was visceral, but it was also nonsensical. Less than a mile from the house, they passed a construction site. It was set back too far from the road for Charlie to see what it was, though it looked abandoned at the moment.
I did a little work over there when I first got here, John said. Some huge demolition project.
He laughed.
You have some weird stuff out here. You wouldn't know by looking at it.
He studied the countryside for a moment.
Isn't that the truth? Charlie said.
Not sure if there was something else she was supposed to say. She was still trying to calm herself. Finally, they came to her driveway. She pulled in with her eyes on the gravel, the house only a dark smudge in her peripheral vision. The last time Charlie had been here, she'd run in and out without pausing to look at anything. All she'd wanted was Theodore, and she had grabbed him and gone. Now she regretted her haste, wishing for some final mental image.
You're not here to say goodbye.
She turned the car off, steeled herself, and looked up. The house was surrounded by trees, and at least three of them had fallen, striking the roof directly. One had landed squarely on the front corner, crushing the walls beneath its weight. Charlie could see through the broken beams and crumbled drywall into the living room. Inside, there was only debris. The front door was intact, though the steps to it were splintered and split. They looked as if they'd give way as soon as they bore weight. Charlie got out of the car and headed toward them.
"What are you doing?"
John's voice was alarmed. Charlie ignored him. She heard his door slam, and he caught her arm, wrenching her back.
"What?" she snapped. "Charlie, look at this place. That house is going to fall over any day now."
"It's not going to fall," she said flatly, but she did gaze up again. The house seemed to be listing to the side, though it must have been an illusion. Surely the foundation itself couldn't have sunk. "I'll be out before I get killed, I promise," she said more gently, and he nodded.
"Go slow," he said.
They carefully climbed the steps to the porch, staying close to the sides, but the wood was sturdier than it looked. They could have taken 3 steps to the right and walked through the open wall, but Charlie took out her key and unlocked the door as John waited patiently, letting her go through the unnecessary ritual. Inside, she paused at the foot of the stairs to the 2nd floor. The holes in the ceiling were beaming down shafts of thin sunlight, dimming as the sun began to wane. It made the place feel almost like some sort of shrine. Charlie tore her eyes away from the holes and started upstairs to her bedroom. As with the outdoor steps, she kept to the side, holding on to the banister. The water damage was visible everywhere. There were dark stains and soft spots in the wood. Charlie reached out to touch a place where the paint had bubbled out from the wall, leaving a pocket of air. Suddenly, a cracking sound came from behind her, and she spun around. John grabbed the banister, struggling to hold on as the stair gave way under him. Charlie reached out, but John braced himself unsteadily. He hissed and gritted his teeth.
"My foot's stuck," he said, nodding down.
Charlie saw that his foot had gone clear through the wood, and now the jagged edges dug into his ankle.
"Okay, hold on," Charlie said.
She crouched down until she could reach him on the step below her, though the awkward angle made it hard to maintain her balance. The wood was only rotting in some places, while in others it was still intact. She grabbed the smaller pieces and pulled them cautiously back from John's foot, her hands growing raw with the rough and splintered surface.
"I think I've got it," John said finally, flexing his ankle.
She looked up and grinned.
"And you thought I was going to get myself killed?"
John gave her a weak smile.
"How about we both make it out alive?"
"Right."
They made their way up the rest of the stairs much more slowly, each of them testing their weight before they took the next step.
"Careful," John warned as Charlie reached the top.
"We won't be here long," Charlie said.
She was much more aware of the danger now. The house's instability grew more obvious with each step they took. The very foundation seemed to wobble from side to side as they moved. Her old bedroom was on the undamaged side of the house, or the side not struck by trees, at least. Charlie stopped in the doorway, and John came up behind her. The floor was strewn with glass. One window had been broken by something, and the shattered glass had blown into the room. She took a deep breath, and it was then that she saw Stanley. The animatronic unicorn had once run on a track around her bedroom. Now he was lying on his side. Charlie went to him and sat down, pulling his head into her lap and patting his rusty cheek. He looked as if he'd been torn violently from his track. His legs were twisted, his hooves missing chunks. When she looked around the room, she saw the missing pieces, still attached to the grooves in the floor.
"Stanley has seen better days,"
John smiled ruefully.
"Yeah,"
Charlie said absently, as she set the toy's head back on the floor.
"John, can you turn that wheel?"
She pointed to a crank soldered together at the foot of her bed. He complied, crossing the floor agonizingly slowly. Charlie bit back her impatience. He turned the crank and she waited for the littlest closet door to open, but nothing happened. John looked at Charlie expectantly. She stood and went to the wall where the three closets stood, closed and apparently untouched by the weather. Even the paint was bright and immaculate. Charlie hesitated, feeling as if she might be disturbing something that no longer belonged to her, then forced the smallest door open. Ella was there, the doll who had been the same size as Charlie when she was much younger. She, like Stanley, had once run around on a track, and she seemed to still be attached to it. She was entirely undamaged. Her dress was clean, and the tray she held in front of her was firm in her motionless hands. Her wide eyes had been gazing into the darkness since the last time Charlie saw her.
"Hi, Ella," Charlie said softly. "I don't suppose you can tell me what I'm looking for."
She scanned over the doll quickly and brushed at her dress.
"You just want to stay in here from now on?"
Charlie studied the tiny frame of the door.
"I don't blame you."
She closed the closet door again without saying goodbye.
"So," she said, turning back to John. He seemed lost in thought, staring at something in his hand.
"What is that?" Charlie asked.
"A photo of you, when you were no bigger than her."
John smiled and gestured toward Ella's door, then handed the picture to Charlie. It looked like a school photo. A short, chubby girl gave a toothy grin for the camera, minus one tooth. Charlie smiled back at her.
"I don't remember this."
"That doll is a little creepy, standing in the closet," John said. "I'm a bit on edge, I won't lie."
"Waiting for a tea party," Charlie said acerbically. "How sinister."
She started to leave the room, but as her hand touched the doorframe, she paused.
Doors.
She stepped back through into her bedroom and looked for a long moment at each of the rectangular closet doors.
"John," she whispered.
"What?"
John looked up, trying to follow Charlie's gaze.
"Doors," Charlie whispered.
She took several long steps back to study the whole wall at once. The scribbles all over her notebooks had been shaped like dozens, hundreds of rectangles. She drew them without thinking, as if they were pushing up through her mind, trying to break out of her subconscious. Now they had.
"They're doors," she repeated.
"Yes, yes, I see."
John tilted his head curiously.
"Are you okay?"
"Yes, I'm fine. I mean, I'm not sure."
She ran her eyes over the wall of the closets again.
"Doors, but not these doors."
"Come on, let's go look at the workshop," John said. "Maybe we can find something else there."
"Right."
She gave a pained smile. She looked back once more at the three closets that sat in silence. John nodded, and they went cautiously back down the stairs, testing each step before they took it. Outside, they stopped by the car. The workshop was invisible from the driveway, hidden behind the house. The backyard had once been surrounded by trees, a small wood that acted as a fence.
"Don't go into the woods, Charlie," she said, then smiled at John. "That's what he always told me, like something out of a fairy tale."
They walked a bit farther, twigs snapping under their feet.
"But the woods were only 10 feet deep," she said, still peering into the trees as though something might leap out.
As a child, these trees had seemed impenetrable, a forest she might be lost in forever if she dared to wander in. She started toward what remained of them, then stopped dead when she saw where some of the fallen trees had landed. Her father's workshop had been crushed. A massive trunk had hit the workshop's roof dead center, and others had come with it on all sides.
The wall closest to the house was still standing, but it was bowed beneath the sagging roof. It had been a garage when they moved in, and then it had become her father's world. A place of light and shadow that smelled of hot metal and burnt plastic. Charlie peered down at the rotting wood and broken glass with careful attention, looking for something she might otherwise miss.
"We're definitely not going in there," John said.
But Charlie was already lifting a piece of sheet metal that had once belonged to the roof. She threw it violently to the side, and it hit the ground with a resounding clang. John startled and kept his distance as Charlie continued to throw things.
What are we looking for?
Charlie wrestled a toy from under the debris and threw it carelessly to the ground behind her, continuing to lift sheets of metal and toss them aside.
Charlie, John whispered,
picking up the delicate toy and cradling it.
He must have made this for you.
Charlie ignored him.
There's got to be something else in here.
She fought her way deeper into the workshop, toppling a wooden beam out of her way. Her hand slipped on the wood, and she realized it was wet. Her arm was bleeding. She wiped her hand on her jeans. From the corner of her eye, she saw John set the toy carefully on the ground and follow her in. Amazingly, there were still shelves and tables standing upright, with tools and shreds of fabric where her father had last set them. Charlie glanced at them for a passing moment, then swept her arm across the table nearest her, knocking everything to the ground. She didn't pause to see what had fallen before moving to the shelves. She began picking things off the nearest shelf one item at a time, inspecting them and throwing them to the ground. When the shelf was empty, she grabbed the board itself with both hands, wrenching at it violently, trying to pull it from the wall. When it didn't come loose, she began pounding at it with her fists.
Stop!
John ran to her and grabbed her hands, pinning them to her sides.
There has to be something here, she screamed. I'm supposed to be here, but I don't know what it is that I'm supposed to find.
What are you talking about? There's a lot left. Look at this stuff.
He held the toy up to her again.
This isn't about the storm, John. It's not about happy memories or closure or whatever you think I need. This is about monsters. They're out there, and they're killing people. And you and I both know that there is only one place they could have come from. Here.
You don't know that, John began.
Charlie looked at him with a stony rage, stopping him short.
I'm surrounded by monsters and murder and death and spirits.
At the last word, her fury ebbed, and she turned away from John, surveying the workshop. She wasn't sure now what damage the storm had done, and what had been her.
All I can think about is Sammy. I feel him. Right now, I can feel him in this place, but he's cut off. It doesn't even make sense. He died before my father and I moved here. But I know I'm here for a reason. There's something that I'm supposed to find. It's all connected, but I don't know how. Maybe something to do with the doors? I don't know.
Hey, okay. We'll find it together.
John reached out for her. Charlie's strength gave way, and she let him pull her close, pressing her face into his shirt.
I know it's hard to see everything torn apart like this, he said.
Charlie's anger drained away, fading into exhaustion. She rested her head on John's shoulder, wishing she could stay like this just a little longer.
Charlie,
John said with alarm, and Charlie came back to attention. He was looking over her shoulder, in the direction of the house. The entire back face of the house had been torn open, as if someone had taken a massive hammer to it. Inside was only dark.
That's right under your room, isn't it? We could have fallen through the floor, John said.
That should be the living room, Charlie said, wiping her sleeve across her face.
Yeah, but it's not.
John looked at her expectantly. That's not even a part of the house, she said. A sudden spark of hope revived inside her. Something was out of place. That meant there was something to find. Charlie approached the chasm, and John didn't try to stop her as she climbed up several large slabs of broken concrete. John stayed a step behind her, close enough to catch her if she slipped. Charlie turned to him before entering.
Thank you, she said.
John nodded.
I've never seen this room before, Charlie whispered as she crept into the hollow space.
The walls were made of dark concrete, and the room was small and windowless, a box jammed into the house and sealed away between the rooms. There were no decorations, and nothing to indicate what was stored here. Just a dirt floor and three large holes, deep and oblong like graves.
Those don't look like storm damage, John said.
They're not.
Charlie went up to the edge of the nearest hole, looking down.
Were you expecting to find these?
These holes were deeper than the ones she'd found at Tracy Horton's house. Perhaps it was the shadowy room, but these looked like real graves. They were a foot or so deeper than the ones she'd found before, and partially filled with loose dirt. John was standing patiently behind her, waiting for her answer.
I've seen them before, she admitted. Behind the house of a dead woman.
What are you talking about?
Charlie sighed.
There was another body. I found her today, in a field. I called Clay, and then I went to her house while he waited for the rest of the cops to show up. There were holes like this in her backyard.
That's what you wouldn't tell me? Another body?
John sounded hurt, but his wounded expression lasted only seconds before it cleared. He started scanning the room again, his eyes intent on the walls and floor.
That and the fact that she looked like me, Charlie thought.
So what do you think the holes are?
He asked finally. Charlie barely heard him. Her gaze had fixed on the blank concrete wall on the far side of the room. It was empty, whitewashed, then left to turn gray with dust and mildew. But something drew her to it. Leaving John alone by the open graves, Charlie walked slowly to it, drawn there by a sense of sudden recognition. It was like she'd just remembered a word that had been on the tip of her tongue for days. She hesitated, holding her hands out flat, less than an inch from the wall, uncertain what was holding her back. She steeled herself and placed her palms against the wall. It was cold. She felt a slight shock of surprise, as though she'd expected to feel warmth from the other side. John was speaking, but to her it was only murmurs in the distance. She turned her head and delicately placed her ear against the surface, closing her eyes.
Movement?
Hey!
John's voice broke her focus, waking her as if from a trance.
Over here!
She turned. John was bent over the mound of dirt next to the farthest grave. Charlie started toward him, but he put up a hand to stop her.
No, come around the other way.
She carefully made her way around the perimeter of the little room until she was beside him. At first, she couldn't tell what he was trying to show her. Something was almost visible, veiled in a thin layer of dirt, so that it blended into the ground as if deliberately camouflaged. But eventually she saw it, rusted metal and the glint of a staring, plastic eye. She glanced at John, who just looked back at her. This was her territory now. Carefully, Charlie poked the mostly buried head of the thing with the toe of her sneaker, then yanked her foot back. The thing didn't move.
What the heck is this?
John asked, glancing around the room.
And why is it in here?
I've never seen this before, Charlie said.
She knelt, curiosity overtaking her fear, then used her hand to scrape aside some of the dirt, clearing off a little more of the creature's face. Behind her, John drew a sharp breath. Charlie just stared down. The creature had no fur, and its face was smooth. It had a short muzzle and oval ears sticking out from the sides of the head. It had the general appearance of an animal's head, though much larger than the animatronic animals from Freddy's. Charlie couldn't guess what kind of animal it was supposed to be. Running down the center of its face was a long, straight split, exposing wires and a line of metal frame. A thick plastic material was stuck to the face in large patches. Maybe it had been encased in it at some point.
"Do you recognize it?" John asked quietly.
Charlie shook her head.
"No,"
she managed to say after a moment.
"Something's wrong with it."
She brushed back more dirt and found it came away easily. The thing had only been partially buried beneath the floor. That, or it had almost escaped. She started digging her hands into the dirt, trying to pry it out of what remained of its grave.
"You've got to be kidding me."
John groaned as he knelt to help, getting his hands around any part of it he could. In one concentrated effort, they heaved it upward, managing to pull most of the torso out of the dirt. They let it drop, then fell back on the ground to study it while they caught their breath. Like the face, the body was smoother than the animatronics that Charlie was used to. It had no fur, and no tail or other animal appendages. It was too large for a human being to wear, probably 8 feet tall when standing. Still, Charlie couldn't shake the feeling that she recognized this creature. Foxy. There was something sick about the creature, a weirdness that gripped her at the most basic, primal level and cried, "This is wrong." Charlie closed her eyes for a moment. Her skin felt strange, like something was crawling all over it.
"It's just an oversized doll."
She took a deep, deliberate breath, opened her eyes, and inched forward to examine the thing. As her hand touched the creature, a wave of nausea hit her, but it lasted only a split second. She continued. She turned the head to the side, its joints resisting. The left side of its skull had been crushed. Charlie could see that the insides were broken, half the wires torn out. Just behind the eye, on the side that had been completely buried, a piece of the casing was missing. She could see a mass of plastic with a tangle of wires running in and out of it. Something had melted one of the circuit boards. Moving slowly down the body, Charlie examined its joints. One arm seemed fine, but on the other, both the shoulder and elbow joints had been bent out of shape. Charlie looked up at John, who was watching her with a worried expression.
"Anything familiar?"
"I don't recognize it. It's not something my dad ever showed me," Charlie said.
"Maybe we should put it back in the ground and get out of here. This feels like it was a mistake."
"But on the inside," Charlie ignored him. "The hardware, the joints, it's older technology. Maybe he made them earlier? I don't know."
"How can you tell?"
"I recognize some of this as my dad's work."
She frowned and pointed at the creature's head. "But then a lot of it is foreign to me. Someone else may have had a hand in it. I'm not sure if my dad made it or not, but I have a feeling he's the one who buried it."
"I can't imagine it was designed to be on stage. It's hideous."
John was noticeably nervous, and now he placed his hand on Charlie's arm.
"Let's get out of here. This place gives me the creeps."
"Gives me the creeps," Charlie said lightly. "Who says that?" "I'm going to try and get it the rest of the way out. I just want to see."
She moved away from John's touch, leaning down to dig again by the creature's buried torso.
"Charlie!"
John cried, just as a metal shriek rang out. The animatronic's arms lifted, and its chest opened like an iron gate. Its metal pieces slid out of place to reveal a dark, gaping pit where sharp spikes and spring locks were just barely visible. It was a trap waiting to be triggered. Yet, disorientingly, something else about it had transformed at the same time. Its artificial skin took on a luminescence, and its movements were fluid and sure. Its casing suddenly appeared to have skin and fur, though they were blurry, flickering like a trick of the light. Charlie jumped backward, but it was too late. The thing had her in its grip and lifted her high into the air. It was pulling her toward it. She beat against its bent and damaged arm, but the other arm steadily forced her closer to the chest cavity. John stumbled backward for a moment, bending forward with one hand over his mouth, as if struck by a wave of nausea. Charlie struggled to break free, but her strength was no match for the creature. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see John lunging toward the beast. He grabbed its head, wrenching at it, trying to force it sideways. Beneath Charlie, the animatronic began to spasm, a stuttering, uncontrolled movement. The creature's grip came loose and its arms swung around wildly. Charlie struggled to get to her feet, but her legs slid in the dirt. The creature seized her again, and its cold fingers drew her closer. Charlie braced her shoe against the ground, trying to give herself leverage, but she was being pulled down by an overwhelming force. Suddenly, she was face to face with the beast, her shoulder already inside its chest cavity. The thing pressed her closer, then suddenly it jerked and released her. She rolled away and heard the sound of snapping spring locks. The creature convulsed on the ground in front of her, headless. Charlie looked at John. He was holding the thing's head in his hands, his eyes wide with shock. He dropped it and kicked it across the floor.
"Are you okay?"
John scrambled to her. Charlie nodded, staring at the broken animatronic head. It still seemed alive. Its fur bristled and skin moved, as if there were muscle and sinew underneath.
"What the heck just happened?"
John raised both hands in surrender. Charlie carefully picked up the massive head and flipped it upside down, peering into it through the base where John had torn it off the neck.
"Ugh."
John bent over, his hands on his knees. His face was pale. He stifled a retching sound. Charlie started toward him, surprised.
"What's wrong with you? You've seen worse than this."
"No, it's not that. I don't know what it is."
He straightened, then stumbled toward the wall, bracing himself.
"It's like there's some horrible smell in the air, but without the smell."
Charlie held her finger to her ear, listening. There was a tone in the air, so high-pitched and quiet it was almost imperceptible.
"I think something is still on," she said.
She set the giant head on the ground. John had a hand to his ear, listening, but when she looked at him, he shook his head.
"I can't hear anything."
Charlie returned to the body of the creature and peered into its gaping chest cavity.
"Are you okay?"
she asked half-heartedly, not taking her eyes off the robot.
"Yeah, I feel better back here."
He heaved and she turned. John's face was strained, and his arm was tight across his stomach.
"I think it's passing," he said,
then doubled over, barely getting out the last syllable.
"This thing!"
Charlie clenched her teeth and jerked her weight back and forth, trying to wrestle something loose from inside the chest cavity.
"Charlie, get away from it!"
John took a step toward her, then swayed back, as if he were tethered to the wall.
"There is something really wrong with that thing."
"Now this I've seen before," Charlie said, as she pulled the object out at last. It was a flat disc, about the size of a half-dollar coin. She held it up to her ear.
"Wow, that's really high-pitched. I can barely hear it. The sound is why you feel sick.
Charlie wedged her fingernail into a small groove on the side of the object and flipped a thin switch. John took several deep breaths, then stood upright again slowly, testing himself. He looked at Charlie.
It stopped, she said.
Charlie, John whispered, nodding toward the beast on the ground.
Charlie looked, and a shock went through her. The illusion of fur and flesh was gone. It was nothing more than a broken robot with unfinished features.
John picked up the head once again, turning it to face them.
That thing, it did something, John said, nodding toward the device in Charlie's hands. Turn it back on.
He lifted the creature's head a bit higher and stared into its lifeless, round eyes.
Are you sure that's a good idea? She was about to say, but curiosity got the better of her. John could handle a little more nausea.
She slipped her nail back into the groove and flipped the tiny switch. Before their eyes, the fractured and worn face became fluid and smooth, warping into something lifelike. John dropped the head and jumped backward.
It's alive.
No, it's not, Charlie whispered, flipping the switch off again.
She cradled the strange device in her hands, gazing down at it, mesmerized.
I want to know more about this. We have to get back to the dorm.
She got to her feet.
I've seen something like this. When I came back here for Theodore, I grabbed a bunch of stuff and put it in a box to study later. I know I saw something like this.
For a long moment, John said nothing. Charlie felt a surge of shame. He was looking at her the way Jessica had, the way he had when he first saw her experiment. The little disc in Charlie's palm felt suddenly like the most vital thing in the world. She closed her hand on it.
Okay, then, John said plainly. Let's go.
His tone was calm, and it caught Charlie off guard. John was being deliberately agreeable. She wasn't sure exactly why, but it was reassuring nonetheless.
Okay, Charlie smiled.